Welcome to the Full FX podcast, Currency Matters. This is our third and sadly final chat with Lee Oliver, who has retired this week from the foreign exchange industry after 40 years in the game. We've gone through broking and dealing through the eyes of Lee and in his various career paths there. So let's look at this century, I guess, because it kind of does coincide with this century. You left the market in sort of 96, 97.
93.
Oh, 93 was it? Okay. So you left the industry in 93. Always get your facts right when you're talking about journalism. That's a good start, isn't it? You left the industry in 93, but you kind of rejoined in 2001, I guess, is really when you came onto people's radar. If you want another spooky coincidence, guess what? I joined P&L in 2001, just after 9/11. So it was like, oh, sorry, just before 9/11. So let's look at it from the perspective there. I think the first thing to observe is that our friends will tell anyone that wants to know that we both claim that we saw e-trading coming and that's why we left trading. And I think our friends will equally say that that is complete nonsense. Fair enough?
Absolutely, yeah.
What got you into journalism?
Well, I had grown bored of foreign exchange, and I'd made a couple of probably bad career choices. And I also realised that I'm not a politician, so I wasn't going to go up the greasy pole. And I've never held back on making my opinions known. I just basically had had enough. And I was in a very fortunate position where my wife was a trader. We had good savings. We had a house that was paid for. No intention of having children at that time. So it's like, okay, well, it's time to go and do something I want to do. So I decided to go to university and I did something that was completely different. I did sports science, and it literally was, well, I do that and I'll see where I end up. And I ended up through a strange path in journalism. I got commissioned when I was at university to write an article on cycling. And I thought, well, you know what? I think I could do this. So I went and did a postgrad diploma in journalism and immediately got forced towards financial journalism, which I didn't really want to do, if I'm honest. I thought, you know, I've been there, seen it, done it. I want to do something different. But it actually made total sense because they figured that I probably knew more than most journalists did about financial markets, which I think is probably 100% true. So I was still determined to stay away from foreign exchange. So I started off in soft commodities.
You weren't missing foreign exchange at all?
No. And actually, if you go back to around the millennium, the foreign exchange was being predicted to die. I think it's one of the few periods where there'd been a really big dip in the volumes as reported by BIS, because the introduction of the euro had taken away all that triangulation that you used to get. And I just got the impression it was a pretty miserable, and talking to my mates, most of them were miserable. So I thought, okay, well, I'll stay away from foreign exchange. And that's what I did. And it did change for me in 2001 because the company I was working for went bankrupt. And obviously after the sad events of 9/11, there just weren't any jobs around. So I then started to freelance, and that took me into, you know, freelance journalism, write about anything that you can get paid for. And I also did some freelance PR and corporate communications. And I was extremely lucky on some of the clients that I picked up because I got to learn about different markets. I got to learn a lot about the futures market and the infrastructure of that market. I did some work for Super Derivatives. I did a lot of work for Super Derivatives. So I was knocking around in the currency options market and all those issues around the way portfolios were being marked to market. And so the way I looked at it, I did okay financially, but I was also actually getting paid to be educated. It was very, 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 very fortuitous. And it taught me as well that you can't look at any single market in isolation if you want to be in it for the long term. You have to be looking at developments in other markets. And if those developments are making that market more efficient, then there's a fair chance it's going to come into your market, whatever market it is. Unless, of course, you're down in the London Metal Exchange where they're still doing this stupid ring trading, which is just beyond me.
And they've gone back in this week, haven't they, as well? It's interesting you say it because I do recall, like, when I joined P&L, the first interview I did was with Fabian Shea at UBS, who were definitely in 2001 the leaders in EFX. They were really pushing you know, the boundaries there. And we were talking about FX options trading online. And I sort of went in there and thinking to myself, like, hang on, they did say FX options. Don't they just mean FX trading online? And you're right. It is actually an eye-opener and education, because from being stuck in one institution, all of a sudden you'll get around every institution and you're getting a lot of different viewpoints and a lot of different, you're seeing a lot of different things, as you say, that will come into your world at some stage. It's quite a fascinating thing. I'm just a little disappointed in one way, actually, that you did go this path, because I've got to say, sports science, 93 to 97, you got a love of cycling. You could easily have been doping Lance Armstrong in 99.
We challenged Lance Armstrong to a race up Outdoors when he was making all this noise about raising money for charity. And I think we offered him 50 grand for a race. And he didn't even come back to us. But we did say to him he had to do it on a chopper with crimp soles. So maybe he didn't fancy it.
Look up choppers, kids. They were fun. They were probably dangerous, and that's why they were fun.
Very dangerous, yeah.
So, okay, now you did come back into FX with Euromoney and the fix. Now, a couple of things we've got to go into. Yours, mine, Shag.
Yeah.
It was just a brilliant. Well, it wasn't an article. It was a series, wasn't it? About how you're going to build this platform.
Well, you know, Colin, after a period of time of being in the foreign exchange market, you're looking at things and you think, I've seen that one before.
Yeah.
And around about that time, what was it? Probably, I don't know when it was. It probably about 2007 or something like, whenever it was. There was all this stuff about the platforms and latency arbitrage and all this other stuff going on. And I just saw the same old stuff getting regurgitated and regurgitated and regurgitated. So I just thought, well, I'll take the mickey out of it. So I sent out this press release, which if I hadn't included the word shag in the name, I probably would have got, it would have been picked up more, but people believed it.
And I remember getting it.
I went back, used my first ever boss, Ron Smith Gaylor, as saying he'd set it up. And Ron had retrained as a plumber. So we said, you know, the problem with latency was easy. You just put a bigger pipe in. And yeah, we had the latency arbitrages will be honor bound or legally bound to quote back for the what are you for me shag button, wasn't it? I think it was.
Yes, it was. Yeah. What are you done? What are you for me shag?
What are you for me shag? And I still read this stuff about these platforms and they're trying to sort this out and trying to sort that out. And I know Last Look is your big bugbear, which I'm fully in agreement with you on that one. And I just look at this sometimes and I think, despite the collective intelligence of all these people working in the industry, there's some real stupidity going on.
Yeah, I think it's short-sightedness more than anything.
And it was fodder for me at Euromoney. And we called the column The Fix because we thought The Fix was such a diabolical product. Right? And at that time, covering FX for Euromoney was quite an easy job because the banks were still proud about being in the industry. They still wanted to be seen to be big players in the industry. So they would do everything they could to get into the magazine. And part of the job I had was filtering out some of the absolute rubbish they told you, which I enjoyed. And I also enjoyed reporting on some of the more ludicrous aspects that the industry was getting up to. And in fact, I had people accuse me of bringing FX into disrepute. I was like, hang on a second there, mate. I'm reporting what you're doing. So who is bringing the industry into disrepute?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was totally clear to me that FX was going to run into problems. Because it had this arrogance about it, that it was self-regulated, that everything was hunky-dory and there wouldn't be any problems. And I was looking at things like MiFID when it came in and looking at the clampdown that the regulators have put onto these other regulated markets and thinking, if you honestly believe that FX is going to be immune from that, you are just stupid. And obviously The Fix was something that I just could not understand. I could not understand how the banks could offer a product that had no spread and expect to make money unless they front run the order. And of course, that's exactly what was going on. And it was called pre-hedging and it's still going on now. And it's still a problem now. And the banks are still in, they might have put it into an algo, but I've heard that they've got algos that front run their own algos and stuff like that. And you're thinking, how long is this going to be repeated for?
I got to be honest, I think, and this goes back to maybe a theme that we had in our second podcast, that I think, generally speaking, the banks have built algos that can replicate the WM mechanism, which they do. They look at it and go, their analytics tell them quite rightly the amount is too much for 5 minutes. Therefore, they go and get rid of it. The customers allow them to do this, and that's where the problem is. The customer's got to turn around and say, like, okay, guys, you know, this is all very well, but you're economically affecting the outcome I'm getting. Therefore, I should see the benefit of that. You know, the banks have always hid behind, oh, well, you know, we're taking on the risk. It could go wrong against us. Well, yeah, I mean, we published something in, I think it was March, some analysis from Rathner of the fix using a longer window. And I think there was something like 3 days in the last year where the overall portfolio would have been better off in the 5 minute window.
Well, Colin, that's all true. But then you also then have to take a step back and say the banks are providing a product that the buyer side wants. So the buy side is not blameless in this, and the buy side was not blameless in the so-called FX scandal or any of this.
Yeah, I would argue the banks didn't provide it. I think it's provided by WM. I mean, you know, you could also argue, I mean, as I think, you know, we kind of agree on as well, that actually if you look at the WM rate, it's meant to be a reference rate, not a traded rate.
Yeah, so it's the son of Frankenstein, isn't it? Because they launched this thing because people wanted to have a reference rate, and fund managers like to hide behind a benchmark. So they're abrogating their responsibility by saying, look, we've been very transparent. I mean, the amount of stupidity in the name of transparency that I've seen over the years is staggering. And I personally, you know, we're all investors. I don't care if the bloke managing my fund executes the FX at 4 o'clock on a Friday or a Thursday or a Wednesday. What I want him to do is make a decision and try and make a decision and manage the risk. Now, if that decision happens to be slightly wrong, so what? Okay, that's fine. But just to stick it all into this thing that was clearly abusable or clearly not fit for purpose, actually, is just stupidity. And I've never got it. I haven't got it for 15 years, and I won't get it in another 15 years. So that's probably why it's time for me to retire.
I'm not quite sure where that leaves me, though. I'm going to have to go and survive the next whatever number of years. I mean, on to happier things, because I think, actually, I mean, there's one thing I've got to ask you one question. I'm not someone given, I like the fact that, you know, we live in a competitive world, and I'm not someone ever given to sort of jealousy that somebody else has got something I didn't, apart from one occasion when you published a story that three blokes stuck in the lift after a good lunch at Roku in Canary Wharf. First question was that genuine?
Yeah.
And how the hell do you get stories like that? I mean, I would kill for something like that. I think that was my favorite foreign exchange story of all of them. Yeah, we were talking about entertainment the other week, and yeah, there's some great entertaining stories, but that one where they were jumping up and down the lift trying to get it to play around and literally got stuck in it.
It's bizarre because you don't come across this. Sometimes I'd be with people and they'd be really, really circumspect about what they were saying to me.
Yeah.
And I always used to say, look, if I'm telling you this is all off the record, it's off the record, it means it's never going to see the light of day. And then other times I'd be there with people and in all sorts of situations, and they'd just tell me things. And I'd sit there thinking, I can't believe you're telling me this. And I think that must have been one of those ones where I think I said to somebody, well, send me a photo then, and the bloke sent me the photo as well.
It was just, I have to say, it was just absolutely awesome, that one.
That's just luck. That was just luck. It wasn't skill. It's like everything else. Sometimes you just get in the right place at the right time. And that was one of those ones.
Let's finally close this out then by talking about like the last stage of your career, which is a bit of a full circle in its own way, because you did come back to markets and FX. Now, what gave you the idea for City FX Wire? Because I have to say, I mean, I've said this in the profit and loss awards over the years. It is one of my favorite products because it really did change the game in how people consumed research. What was the thinking behind it?
What happened is, again, I found myself in the right place at the right time. So Citibank had decided that it wanted to become top of the Euromoney poll again. So they thought that if it hired me, it would get some insight into how the poll worked, which was true. But it also had gone out and hired the bank sales team from UBS. So the bank sales team came in, and a chap called Bruno Widmer, who brought them over, was aware that he wanted to have a low-touch information service. And it was initially thought it would be for the bank clients. So I'd never seen UBS Buzz, but he said, look, UBS has got this thing called UBS Buzz and it gives a bit of information out. And then from that moment, they just gave me a blank sheet of paper. The way I've tended to look at a lot of things is, you know, when I joined Citi, they said, should we be spending more money on advertising? I said, well, when you read a magazine, how many of the adverts do you look at? And the general answer is none. So, well, there's your answer. The answer is no. You shouldn't be spending money on advertising. And it was the same thing about information, providing information. And I think the first rule of journalism is to know your audience. So we knew the audience. We knew the audience. And, okay, so there's corporates, there's hedge funds, there's banks, there's all sorts of people, pension funds, whatever you want. That was Citi's broad church. So clearly you can't have a single product that's going to appeal to them, but you've got to try and think of something that will be a broad product that will have something for everybody. And I was convinced from even when I was a trader that the news that was being provided to me was not what I wanted to read. And that's probably because the people that were writing it didn't understand what they were doing. So I had a blank sheet of paper and I came up with this idea about bolting effectively a new service onto Velocity. And I got some major helpful input. Oh, I was also lucky at that time, Colin, because I think John Havers, who was the number two at the bank, had sent out an edict just before I joined about how he wanted the bank to capitalize on its proprietary information. So obviously the bank is generating vast amounts of really, really useful knowledge, but it wasn't really capitalizing on it. And in fact, even its formal production was just a mess. So research had been hived off and we had strategy which wasn't research, but there was no standardization of content. There were no standardization of the way the new it was presented, of templates or anything. It was just a mess. So I came up with this idea about creating this newswire. Anil Prasad then said to me, look, you cannot possibly write about every single thing we cover, so I'm going to make the traders post commentary onto the site.
Which is kind of what UBS Buzz did.
Yeah, the traders didn't particularly like that, but then they got used to it. And the safety valve was that it wouldn't go live until we checked it. So I was checking this content for the sort of information that then leaked into the chat. So it got so many people into trouble. And it worked very, very well. It worked very, very well until it was always under-resourced. There was lots of things I wanted to do with it in terms of embedding deal tickets into the content and things like that, which was actually technically quite easy, but we never got around to doing it.
Well, again, not to give them a plug, but UBS actually did that back in the day, didn't they? They would have agree, disagree, and a trade ticket would be populated for you.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, you can see we've seen a lot of leverage guys sit in euro dollar and you put a ticket in and something might trade. And it's also then it's a way, then it started to become, then it would have started to have become a way of actually, I hate the word, but monetizing the content. Because all I ever heard from content producers was about how their content was value adding. Now, once I built this system, I could tell you that a lot of it wasn't. And I could tell you that because I could see it wasn't being read. Right. So for instance, the allocation that the FX business had to research was huge. It was unbelievably huge. And I could see that maybe 25 people would read a bit of research on the site. But you'd stick out something from one of the traders, or to be fair to them, the strategy guys, because they were very good. They were good. The strategy guys at Citi were good. They just needed to have some help about the way they presented their information. But you've got 25 people reading a piece of research that's probably cost us, you know, 10 grand to produce because that's the allocation. Or I've got 2,000 customers reading the piece that's been sent out by the desk strategy guys. And so I started to then get frustrated that we were basically being charged too much for stuff that nobody was reading. And there wasn't the political will to basically tell research, we're not paying for it. But that was the whole concept of what it was about. So it was about putting all of the content into one place and tagging it so that you could find what you wanted easily. It wasn't particularly complicated.
A lot of the great ideas aren't. There's some simple stuff out there. You think, why has not been done before? Well, sometimes because you need the idea, sometimes you need resources. But, you know, it doesn't have to be overly complicated to actually, like, be a really good idea. And on a lot of the trading platforms I've seen, it's very much that. So what kind of triggered the move into InTouch?
Oh, well, I basically got shafted, like everybody does generally when you work for certain banks. And I didn't really have any option but to leave. And then I gave evidence for some of the traders at employment tribunals, which everybody told me was the right thing to do. But for a career point of view, it was, wasn't going to do me any favours, but it was still the right thing to do. And then I basically I tried to go back to where I was in 2001, 2002 and set up, you know, a freelance business effectively. But for whatever reason, I found that very, very difficult to do. And at the end of August 2017, I got approached by David Fuller, who runs InTouch Capital Markets, who I had known from 25 years ago, asking me if I would help out with the company's FX product, which was, it got past the startup stage, but it was floundering. And so I said, look, I'll come in and I'll help you out for 3 months and then you can decide who you want to get in to run it. But I'm really looking to retire and I'm not really interested. And the company kept saying to me, look, we want you to do the job. So they gave me a free option on it, effectively. I got in and decided that I wanted to make a few changes and get a few people in, which I did. I got some extremely talented people in, covering Rob Hoodless to cover senior. Adrian Thong came in to run New York for me, you know, and the thing we had in common with, they were ex-City people, so I knew exactly how good they were, what they did. And then we slowly expanded, and we've expanded now. I've actually replaced myself with a guy called Piotr Matis, who came from Rabobank, very, very highly regarded senior strategist. And Peter Frank, who has knocked around for quite a long time, SocGen, Deutsche Bank, he's a good strategy guy, very, very smart economist. Todd Elmer, who's another Citibank waif. And of course, the legendary Keith Thack.
Yes, Thack is there, isn't he? Yes.
Thack is here. Yeah, Thack is there. So the team is very, very strong. They're still all enthusiastic about the FX market. There's no ego with any of them. So we'll get asked a question. You don't know the answer. You don't really bullshit. You go and find out what the answer is. And I think that's proved popular with the client base. It's expanded quite rapidly. And I would say that, you know, the looking ahead for InTouch FX, ITC FX, one of the business risks is that we're going to see a reduced workforce in the foreign exchange industry. And that's happening. You hear that all the time about senior people getting let go. But one of the business opportunities is this juniorization thing. So, I mean, I can see it. The chats have evolved. You know, when I first started, people wouldn't say anything to you. They're too scared to say anything in the chats. And this is a legacy from the scandal. But people now will come in and they will ask a question and the team will try and find them an answer. And they could be hard questions or they could be difficult questions. And the client base literally ranges. Again, it's about building this broad church, Colin. It ranges from individual traders trading their own money through to global, whatever you want to call them nowadays, bulge bracket banks, to hedge funds, agency brokers, etc. So the audience is very, very broad, and it's about trying to provide something that they all want to read.
How much of it is about having an opinion? Because I think that's the other thing as well, is that, yes, I mean, you know, the economists and strategists in the banks do have an opinion, but, you know, the people on the desk who are talking to the customers a lot of the time, as you say, are quite wary of having such an opinion. You know, there's all these different rules around what constitutes advice and so on. And do you think that, you know, the fact that, you know, InTouch has got people with undoubted street cred and that have an opinion, do you think that plays a big role?
It does, but the way the opinion is presented has to be thought out quite carefully, because we're not regulated. But you can still express an opinion. It's the same as how do you report activity in the FX market? Well, you don't say, I just got paid by X hedge fund at 63, right? But if you've seen several funds buying something and say there's been a bit of interest from the leverage community, and you kind of said the same thing, but you haven't been specific. And so sometimes they will produce what I would call, you know, proper formal strategy pieces, which would be along the lines of, you know, in previous NFP releases, we have seen this and we don't think it will be any different this time around. to being, well, you know, if this level goes, we hear there could be some interest. I stopped, you know. It's just the way you phrase it. And I think what I hear is that there's a real shortage of that type of information coming from anywhere. So the banks are, this is the most ludicrous example we had, Colin, was a sales guy at a bank came on and he told me that he took the service because he used to get the type of color we were providing from his traders, but now the traders won't post anything. And you can understand why a trader doesn't want to put something in a Bloomberg chat if in 7 years later he's going to get fired for it.
It's interesting, isn't it, in a way, because it's kind of gone full circle. Because it used to be that we would get a lot of our information from outside sources. You know, you'd be talking to someone, or you'd be looking at the news wires, or your broker even would give you some information in terms of, okay, look, you know, we're 30-33, decent sized bid.
I don't even know if they're allowed to say that anymore, are they?
I'm sure they're not, but in many ways, though, it's just a question of how you say it.
I mean, it depends on, again, I think from my understanding of it, is it depends on which platform you're looking at as well, how much you can see of the order book. And that's actually an interesting point as well. So the order book, when I started looking at Bund futures back in 97, 98, and you could see the whole order book, and it was, you know, if you put Bund future next to euro dollar, you know, they're trading exactly the same way. And the FX market was convinced if you put your bid into EBS at that time for 100 and the offer was only for 3, it was going to go higher. Well, that wasn't what happened in Bunds. Because you could have a bid in there for 1,000 contracts and an offer for 1, and it would still go down. And it would go down because somebody had to sell. And people in FX didn't realize that for a long, long time. So the information in some ways is probably harder to sort, because you're not hearing it verbally. I doubt you're even seeing it from basically sticking a price into the broker and getting given by Nagara or something.
Yeah, and there's a lot of white noise out there as well.
Yeah.
Is this actually going to be the final farewell to foreign exchange? We're not going to start calling you Frank Sinatra or anything like that, are we?
No, I mean, I want to have a bit of a detox. But if somebody came up and said to me, would I look at a project or something, I might be interested. So, but I'm not going to go back into full-time employment. I just, I'm 58. I think I've still got a bit of life left in me yet, and I want to get the most out of it.
Well, I wish you luck, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Good on you. It's been great talking to you. To wrap up all three of our podcasts, I think we can bring in the themes of all three, because when I do manage to get to London, we are going to go out for a biblical lunch where the entertainment will be off the scale.
Yep.
We'll be talking about banking, broking, and the current world. The world will be a better place when we're finished, I'm sure. But in the meantime, thanks for giving me all your time over these podcasts, and the very best of luck.
Well, before you go, Colin, thank you very much for the last, 20 plus years that I've known you. And I wish you all the best with the full FX, because there's definitely a need for a product like your product. And I think you're doing a great job with it. And I wish you all the success with that.
Everybody has now turned off because we started praising each other. It's not the foreign exchange way. To our listeners, thank you very much for listening. And remember, you can download us and subscribe on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And we'll be back soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Full FX podcast. Our weekly newsletter carries exclusive content that doesn't appear on our website. If you want to know the latest people moves, read about some of the stranger aspects of our industry, and keep up to date on Colin Lambert's trade of the year, then register now at thefullfx.com. It's free and delivered to your inbox every Tuesday.